Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sam Mullett Sr. and 15 other members of a breakaway Amish group face a decade in prison on hate crime charges. They were convicted last week in federal court in a series of beard and haircutting attacks on fellow Amish in Northeast Ohio. The case made headlines around the world and shined a light on this unique and very private community. Coming up, we'll talk to two sociology professors who have studied the Amish. They're one from the College of Worcester, close to the heart of Amish country, and the other here at Ohio State. But first, joining me now is James McCarty. He's a reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He followed the beard-cutting case. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you, Ann. It's my pleasure.
I want to put a question out there for our listeners. The Amish usually are averse to involvement with outside government. Do you think that was a good exception in this case? Why or why not? Give us a call and tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Jim, first of all, what was it like in the courtroom with the Amish in there? That's got to be something, I'm going to guess, you've never covered before?
No. I have covered an Amish defendant before. Monroe Beachy was a few months ago. He was they called him the Amish Bernie Madoff. But that never went to trial. That was just a plea and a sentencing, and then we were done with them. This was 3 weeks with a courtroom full of Amish men and women. It was what we kind of described as a Sunday communal dinner party. We had 16 defendants, and each one of them had their own attorneys, all seated at about five tables with tablecloths on top of them in the front of the courtroom. And almost the entire gallery was filled with men and women in traditional Amish dress. They came round trip, 200-mile round trips every day, 100 miles each way, paid a van driver to bring them. They stayed in the courthouse. They had lunch in the cafeteria. They were a windfall for the cafeteria. They apparently they had to make double whatever they were making for the special of the day on the lunches. So the cafeteria crew loved the Amish. They sat in the dining room during lunch breaks, they're very, very nice. I'd ride up and down in the elevators with them and would talk a little bit. And the Burgholz Amish, the supporters of the defendants, were on one side of the courtroom, and the people from, say, Holmes and Trumbull and Geauga counties were on the left side of the courtroom behind the prosecutors. So they were split, and they didn't really co-mingle. They are not friendly with each other.
My guest is Jim McCarty. He's a reporter for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. We're talking about the three-week trial of Sam Mullett Sr. and 15 other members of a breakaway Amish group for the haircutting charges. They were called hate crime charges, or they're considered hate crimes. If you have a question or comment for Jim, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And to our listeners, do you think this was a good time to bring the Amish out into court and make an exception to the rule that we usually do ignore what they do legally? I was surprised, Jim, that so many of them showed up. I get it that the defendants had to be there, but maybe their family members and, of course, the witnesses. But I was surprised that they attracted such a large Amish crowd.
Yeah, they were there more as a show of support.
Right.
On the case for the Burgholz Amish, supporting the defendants. On the other side, they were supporting the witnesses because I would say more than half of the witnesses were Amish, either victims of hair or beard cuttings or just witnesses, children of some of the victims. They brought their kind of support groups, and some of the people on, supporting the prosecution, two of them were Sam Mullett's brothers, and one was his sister, who was a victim, Barbara Miller.
Well, that's the thing; these are people who are very close.
They are. They were. I would say, in one way or another, either through marriage or blood, every one of the defendants was related to Sam Mullett. So these are like they had married his grandchildren, or they were his own. Three of the defendants were his sons, and one was his daughter. And then their spouses were many of the defendants. So it was a family affair as far as the defense goes, and a lot of the victims were related to the defendants. They were.
How did it wind up in court? Who pressed charges?
Well, there were 9 victims in 5 attacks, and it is the Amish way not to bring in the outside law, but. In this case, the other bishops kind of got together. There's bishops all through Holmes County. I don't know exactly how many, but about a half dozen of them got together and spoke to the victims and convinced them that it is their duty to talk to the sheriff's departments and the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI and to bring a stop to this, because they really had terrorized the peaceful Amish communities in Holmes and Geauga and Trumbull and throughout Ohio. So it was something that they did not want to do, but they did it for justice and the safety of their brethren.
Stephen in Columbus, you're taking my next question, so I'll let you have it.
Oh, this is Stephen. Hi,
yep.
Anne.
Hi.
So my question was, what transgression did the victims do in the eyes of the defendants that said that they needed to be punished by having their hair cut?
Okay, that's a good question. This all goes to a series of excommunications. Not all of it, but many of them are linked to an excommunications that Sam Mullett did of people who either left his community, who he didn't want to leave, or who did something religious or another to upset him. There are also parents of some of the defendants who the children were upset with. And there was a third. There was also Sam Mullett's daughter had lost 2 of her children through a custody battle with her husband. There was actually a divorce of his daughter from her husband, which is almost unheard of in the Amish community. Mm-hmm. And he, in all 3 of the of those instances, resulted in 9 people having their hair cut or beards cut in 5 attacks.
And what does their hair represent?
It's sacred to them. It's not just traditional. I mean, this goes back to the 1600s when the Amish were founded in Europe. But it's considered sacred. Once a man and a woman are married, they don't cut their hair or shave their beard, except for in the man's case, they shave the mustache. But and the women wear it in long braids and they wrap it underneath their caps or their bonnets, and it's something that they just don't it's sacred, and to cut it is humiliating to them, and it's horribly embarrassing, and in the case of the mullet group, they actually did something also very un-Amish. They bought a disposable camera and memorialized these attacks with snapshots, and horribly embarrassing, and they got a good laugh out of it among the mullet group.
Yeah, I mean, having their photographs taken is another no-no.
Right, right. I mean, I know Amish. I'm very familiar with them through the Holmes County Amish. They're spectacular bird watchers, and so I know them from birding, and I just know that they're not into They don't like their photographs taken. It's not like they think the camera's going to steal their soul or anything. They're humble people, and they just don't want to
It's modesty, right?
It's modesty, like right?
Okay.
Right.
Hey, Stephen, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Take care. So, what was the reaction to the guilty verdict? Or verdicts, I should say.
It was surprise. It was shock. It was at least from the defense, I don't think they were expecting any of this. I know that Sam Mullett's lawyer said he was flabbergasted. He had no idea that they would not only his client be slammed with this verdict, but every one of the defendants were all convicted of hate crimes, and which carry a federal sentencing guidelines a minimum of 17 years in prison. Now the judge doesn't have to follow that, but I'm sure that some of the women who really didn't do too much other than kind of restrain some of the wives during the attacks, I doubt they're going to get very much. But, you know, Sam could get a 10 years or more in prison. I'm sure the prosecutors will ask for it. They'll probably ask for the, you know, 17 and a half years, the minimum of the guidelines.
And, you know, the whole hair cutting thing and everything that they did and taking the photographs, it just seems really kind of, it's very mean-spirited, and it's not something we typically, naively perhaps, mm-hmm. but typically or stereotypically associate with the Amish.
Well, you're right. They don't fight. They don't go to war. They hunt, you know, with mm-hmm. guns, but they really don't, get into it with each other very often. So that's why this was unusual to begin with. And then the fact that they really were physical. I mean, yeah. Some of the photographs, I don't know if you were able to see them, but in one, Johnny Mullet, Sam's son, is just grabbing the beard of an old Amish bishop named Ray Hershberger. And they were, I mean, we heard from the evidence that these men were dragged out of their bed in their nightshirts by their beard. I mean, and in many cases, they were bloodied either by, you know, nicks and cuts or whatever. And it was a brutal thing. I mean, some of the victims, fought back, and they had to be held and held down, and it wasn't a clean cut. It was a hacking job, actually, very rough. They were very rough with the victims.
Now it was prosecuted as a hate crime in federal court.
Mm-hmm.
What was the distinction here that made it a hate crime?
This was a first for Ohio. The key elements that elevated this above just a simple assault, you know, of a beard or a hair cutting, was the fact that it was religiously motivated. That was a key element that the jury had to find in order to find them guilty of a hate crime. And the other element was that it involved bodily injury. And in the case of some of these, it was very minimal. Like I said, Sam Mullet's lawyer described it as nicks and cuts, or is what's going to send these people to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Disfigurement was an element of bodily injury. But in the case of the only attacks in which the defendants were acquitted were in a hair and beard cutting in which the man was not nicked or cut. You know, he was not brutalized. He was just cut. And they found the defendants not guilty in that case. So this could be, you know, grounds for appeal maybe down the road, just because the injuries were minimal. As far as bodily injury goes.
But although, it seems like the larger crime was the offense of cutting the hair in the first place, since that's something so closely related to their religion.
It was. And if it was...
if they cut the hair, whether they nicked him or not.
Right. The hair is, like we said, it's sacred for both the men and women. And to cut it is humiliating, and it was, you know, that was the intention. So it's a religious humiliation and a bodily disfigurement of the victims. So that elevated it to a hate crime. And, it's out of the jury's hand now. It's up mm-hmm. to the judge and the defense lawyers and the prosecutors to determine, you know, how much these people get in prison.
Jim McCarty, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. It's been a pleasure, and it's been fun.
James McCarty, he's a reporter for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. Coming up, David McConnell, he's a professor of anthropology and sociology at the College of Worcester. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, this summer, the Arctic ice cap shrank, melted to an all-time tiny size, half what it was in 1980. The planet is changing. We will explore. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 43 degrees with sunshine and a high of 67 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 46. There's a chance of rain for Tuesday, a high of 71 degrees, and rain likely Tuesday night. Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Ohio has one of the largest Amish populations in the country. Some 60,000 live here, and Holmes County in Northeast Ohio is pretty much at the center of the community. For most of us, our interaction with the Amish is limited, as they are intensely private and are rarely in the news. But the recent three-week trial and conviction of a breakaway Amish leader and 15 of his followers for hate crimes gave us a tiny glimpse. Joining me now is Dr. David McConnell, who is a professor of sociology and anthropology at the College of Worcester. Dr. McConnell has conducted field research on the Amish in Holmes County and has written a book on the topic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So to what extent are how many different Amish groups are there? It's not like the Catholic Church where there's the Pope. They're all separate, right?
That's right. There's an astounding level of diversity in the Amish society. And in Holmes County alone, there are 12 different affiliations. So I can walk down, you know, a mile of County Road 77 and see families from at least four or five different affiliations right there. And fortunately, though, there are four affiliations that make up about 97% of the Amish in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about the Schwarzentruber Amish, the Andy Weaver Amish, the Old Order Amish, and the New Order Amish, these are the four largest affiliations in our area. These are groups that have really come to, you know, different decisions about the role of technology, the severity of shunning, that kind of thing. And because of those different doctrinal stances, they will only share their ordained leaders among themselves. So that's really the definition of an affiliation. It's just a group of church districts, and each church district is about 30 to 40 families, a group of church districts that have agreed to be in fellowship with each other and will share their ordained leaders at funerals and church services and weddings and that kind of thing.
Now, Jim McCarty mentioned just a few minutes ago that the Amish have been around since like the 1600s when the religion was formed. Have they always had that proclivity for smaller groups and breaking away like this?
Well, the church district has always been the kind of central building block of Amish society beyond the family. But actually, the church divisions really didn't start until the early 1900s. You had the first one in about 1913 with the Schwarzentruber group breaking off from the Old Order. And then there were a series of other divisions in the 1950s and 60s that revolved around, again, the severity of shunning and how to handle the rite of passage that's known as Rumspringa, differences over technology use, and so forth. So actually, it's really been within the last century that these church schisms or divisions have taken place.
The reaction in the Amish community to the convictions, what I've read about it was that it was appalled and shocked on both sides because of the severity of the possible penalties. The folks that I've read, they really didn't understand or don't understand very much how the system works outside.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think there was a lot of shock. You know, most of the time Amish try to settle their disputes informally. They're very reluctant to go to the law, as they say, and as a result, there's not as much familiarity with the legal system as you might expect. But I'm also hearing on the other side, you know, some relief too. At least my Amish friends and acquaintances were quite worried that Sam Mullet and some of his followers might be acquitted or just get a slap on the wrist, because, you know, many feared that he would cause even greater harm if he got out of jail without a firm reprimand. So,
well, that's another thing. It doesn't, like I mentioned to Jim McCarty once again, our impressions or our stereotypes about Amish aren't violent, and this really feels or seems very, very violent.
Right, and I think that's contributed to the degree to which the Amish have really distanced themselves from Sam Mullet. I've been amazed at, you know, that right from the beginning they agreed to turn to law enforcement on the night of the attacks, their willingness to testify at the trial. Just the number of Amish friends and acquaintances I've talked with who describe Sam and the Bergholz group as a cult, you know, these all speak, I think, to the fact that they were very disturbed by the level of violence, as Jim was saying, the bodily intrusiveness of the attacks, you know, I think they really feel that he and his group are way out in left field. They've moved quickly to distance themselves from him.
What's the commonality among the groups, except maybe something like, you know, the Bergholz group? What holds them together as a religion?
Well, I think many Amish are asking
same question
now. I've had them describe, you know, Sam as unchristian, a wolf in sheep's clothing. I think is that the actions of he and his followers have really, you know, come as a shock and a surprise to most Amish. And the interesting thing, too, that's worth noting is that, you know, his group was probably the only church district that I know of, at least in this area, that was not in affiliation or in fellowship with any other Amish church district. And so, you know, all the other Amish had agreed, basically, that they would not share their ordained leaders with Sam's group, would not affiliate with him. And that's a very powerful statement of just how much of an outlier he was viewed as.
I have an email from Charlie in Columbus. Charlie writes, "The Amish are U.S. citizens, right? They should be subject to all of the laws the rest of us are subject to. I'm not sure why we afford them special exceptions just because they appear so different." Now, I don't think it's about appearance, right?
Right, right. And most, you know, the Amish do abide by all of the rules that we do. They pay taxes just like everyone else. There's a misconception out there that they don't pay taxes, but they do. You know, they do make it a priority to follow the rules of the country. There have been a few cases, such as the 1972 Supreme Court decision in Wisconsin versus Yoder, where the Amish were allowed to maintain their own schools and, in a sense, were exempted from the compulsory education law up to age 16. They only have to go until 14 years of age. So there certainly have been some accommodations in U.S. law for the Amish, but as a rule, they are very law-abiding, and they take that very seriously.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and right now I'm talking with David McConnell. He's a professor of anthropology and sociology at the College of Worcester. We're talking about the Amish in Ohio, and as a follow-up to the trial, 16 men and women who rejected a lenient plea deal are facing lengthy prison terms for their convictions in the hair and beard cutting attacks on fellow Amish in the state of Ohio. If you have a question or comment for my guest, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. From Jean on email, she asks, "Has your guest heard of the new show Breaking Amish? It is about teenagers who leave their Amish families to go to the big city, and some of them go wild, drinking, getting tattoos, buying sexy clothes, etc. The parents of some of these kids appear on camera, too. It surprises me that this show exists, and it surprises me that the parents are on camera." What do you make of that, David McConnell?
Well, I think this is just a rehash of Amish in the City, which was a similar reality show that aired some years ago. And, you know, we have this fascination with Amish in this period of Rumspringa after they turn 16, when they can branch out a little bit and, you know, there's not as much parental supervision as they've had up until that point. And the idea is that, you know, after they turn 16, they need to make a decision about whether they want to be Amish or not. They're supposed to be looking for a lifelong partner during that period as well. But I think in the public mind, Rumspringa has come to be associated with wild Rumspringa and nonstop parties and alcohol and drugs and that kind of thing. And I think I have seen the trailer for Breaking Amish, and first of all, it's important to note that most of the young people who appear in that are likely not going to be joining the church. And the other thing is the premise is often, at least from the trailer, it seems like it's set up as if, you know, they have this defined period of time while they're in New York City to make this decision about whether to be Amish or not. And that's, you know, not the way it works. They typically have as long as they like to kind of explore English society and make that decision. And in the end, 85% of Amish do end up, you know, joining the church, taking their vows, and staying Amish. So that percentage is actually about the highest it's ever been since the Amish came to the U.S.
You mentioned earlier that the big division started to occur around 1913, you know, after the Industrial Revolution was well established. So I was wondering about the whole issue of technology. I know they're averse to any technology. Why is that in general?
Well, I think the stance most Amish take on technology comes from the biblical injunction to kind of remain separate from the world. But the fact is that, you know, most Amish have made accommodations to a variety of technologies, and their use of technology is actually, I think, much more creative and much more common and sophisticated maybe than we usually imagine. They're not allowed to use electricity from the grid, for example, but they are able to use generators, diesel engines, inverters to power small appliances, and so what are called pneumatic or air-powered and oil-powered tools that run off a generator. What all of this collectively has been termed Amish electricity. And that's just one example of the ways that, you know, they are able to use technology, but they put restrictions on it. And typically the line in the sand that they will draw is they'll try to ascertain whether a particular technology is going to seriously interfere with family and community life. So they've drawn the line on owning cars. Most of them will ride in cars. But ownership of cars, they feel, will take their young people out of the community. It will splinter the family groups in ways that they don't want. And so, you know, while that distinction may seem kind of strange that you can ride in a car but not own a car, to most of us, it actually makes perfect sense to them.
Going back to the education issue, you said they educate them till they're about 14. What do they teach them about the outside world?
Well, I just took my students on a field trip down to an Amish school, and it's a very kind of bare-bones curriculum focused on reading, writing, and arithmetic. There's not a lot of religious instruction in the schools, in spite of what you might expect. The atmosphere is very serious. There's a lot of seat work, students kind of moving up and back and forth up to the front of the room with the teacher to work on various math and reading problems. And the medium of instruction is English in those schools. And so they see those 8 years really as a chance to make sure that all of their children learn to speak English fluently because they know that their livelihood, their economic livelihood, is really tied to being able to interact with the rest of the world. And that's one of the most surprising changes that we've seen in Amish life in the past few decades, is the shift away from farming into cottage industries. In the Holmes County settlement, less than 10% of the Amish now make a living through full-time farming. And so they have to be able to interact with the outside world with all of these micro enterprises that are popping up all over the landscape.
They've become somewhat controversial as well for their role in the big animal auctions, particularly the dog auctions.
Yes.
They don't see the animals the same way.
Right, right. And I think there is a different viewpoint there. We see it with the dog auctions. We see it with deer farming. There's more of an emphasis on the idea that these animals are livestock. They're there for our use, but to be fair, those puppy mills and the deer farms, they're controversial even within the Amish community.
They are, okay.
So not all Amish support them. There's an interesting debate going on now within the Amish community about some of those new kinds of cottage industries that seem to kind of push the limits on what you might think is right or humane treatment of animals.
How much does, in general, the Amish community, and you've already described that there's lots of iterations of it, even just in Ohio, but how in general does it reflect or does it look like what it did 400 years ago?
It looks the same in some respects. We still find, as I said before, very small church districts, 30 to 40 families. These are face-to-face communities where they meet for church every other Sunday in someone else's home. I think that basic structural form has been remarkably consistent over the last 300 or 400 years. But where we have seen the most changes, I think, is again in the move away from farming. There were some who predicted that the Amish would cease to exist as a group if they ever gave up farming in large numbers. But they've made a remarkable transition to these cottage industries, but it has brought them into, kind of an increasing economic entanglement, if you will, with the rest of the world, and that's made things challenging for them. And the other thing is that, Amish settlements are increasingly crowded places in terms of other Amish groups. And so we're used to kind of thinking about the Amish negotiating with the federal government or the state government or local government, negotiating with the English world. But in fact, they have to rub shoulders with the other Amish groups who've made different decisions about church doctrine, have defined separation from the world in different ways. And that can be very challenging, as we saw with the Sam Mullet case.
David McConnell, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
David McConnell is a professor of anthropology and sociology at the College of Worcester. He's also conducted field research on the Amish in Holmes County and written a book about them. Coming up, we're going to hear from Joe Donnermeyer. He's a professor of rural sociology in the School of Environment and Natural Resources at Ohio State University. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio by the Society of Professional Journalists for the third year in a row.
The first responding officers were confronted by lions, tigers, a grizzly bear.
She's a single mom with four children. She works as a part-time medical assistant. She makes only $1,300 a month.
Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and at our award-winning website, WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour two of All Sides begins, and a discussion of the housing market. It's always changing, and on the second hour of All Sides, we'll talk about hot trends in housing. Stay with us from 11 till noon. It's 43 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today with a high of 67. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 46 degrees. Cloudy with a chance of rain on Tuesday, about a 50% chance of rain, and a high of 71. Rain likely Tuesday night. Guided by instinct, animal architects build a remarkable variety of elaborate dwellings with their simple supplies. Watch Nature, the Animal House, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Sam Mullet Sr. and 15 other members of a breakaway Amish group face a decade in prison on hate crime charges. They were convicted last week after 3 weeks in federal court in a series of beard and haircutting attacks on fellow Amish in Northeast Ohio. The case made headlines around the world and shined a light on this unique and very private community. Continue our conversation about the community is Dr. Joe Donnermeyer. He's a professor of rural sociology in the School of Environment and Natural Resources at Ohio State. His research focused on changes in Amish society, including the growth in population and settlements, and changes in the occupational base of the Amish. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
You know, it has been written that in some cases, some of these people, it's the both parents of families that are face imprisonment, and that the loss of these people could destroy the community.
I think there's a strong possibility that will happen, but probably in a little bit of a different way. It will not be that the parents are in prison and the children have nowhere to go. Of course, extended family will take care of them. What I think is going to happen at this point is that the community will disperse. That is, the remaining members are likely to move to other communities where they can be allowed in and become part of that church group. And I think it will simply disintegrate over time. This would not be the first time that a, quote, renegade group of Amish have had a very short life. There was a group that was unique that had moved down to Cookeville, Tennessee, that lasted about 10 years, and eventually that one also fell apart. Now, they were very law-abiding. They had other ideas and things that they were trying to do. And eventually the remnants of that moved up to Maine, were put into a probationary period under the supervision of bishops from Michigan, and were subsequently allowed to fellowship again with the Amish. And since then, they've done quite well. I suspect this Burkholz group will simply disintegrate and the remaining families will disperse and will seek to find new church groups in which they will be allowed to fellowship.
How much does the Amish community at large shape change like this and shift around? Does it take a kind of a, I don't like to use the word catastrophic, but an extreme event like this to make it happen, or how does it work?
You know, in fact, the Amish have a long history of moving frequently. They completely relocated from Europe to begin with, and when they began to settle in the first half of the 18th century in America in about 1730 or so, they made a rapid movement west as the frontier line also pushed west. And since then, they have begun to found many, many new communities, and so many families are moving all the time, trying to find a place where they can have a rural way of life, a good way to make a living for their families, and, of course, a tight-knit church group in which they feel comfortable. So I think that, in general, moving has been one of the ways that the Amish have been able to sustain their culture and keep it healthy, and that will continue into the foreseeable future.
My guest is Joe Donnermeyer. He is a professor of rural sociology at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment for him, we are talking about the Amish. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email, or I'm sorry, a comment from Arlen on Facebook. Arlen writes, there has been a lot of talk about the Amish as a religion. My understanding from my wife, who is from Adams County, an Amish community area, that the Amish way of life isn't the religion in and of itself. I'm not sure what religion they are, but I'm pretty sure it's a way of life.
He is correct and incorrect at the same time. I presume he means he's from Adams County in southern Ohio, as there's also an Adams County in Indiana on the border with western Ohio. And I know that community down in West Union in southern Ohio. The way of life is a form of expressing the fundamental religious beliefs of the Amish. The Amish are a branch of the Protestant Reformation, so they are a Christian group, and they simply seek to translate what is mostly the New Testament into a way of life that keeps them partially and symbolically separate from mainstream society. But they're certainly a Christian group. They wouldn't be anything else but. And so with the freedom of religion in American society, when they moved here, from Europe and all of the persecution they were suffering in Europe, they began to thrive in the United States.
Is there an Amish hierarchy? We've been talking about the bishops, but does it kind of end there? And how do they work it out?
That it is amazing the amount of conformity that that is expressed in Amish society, given that there is no hierarchy beyond an individual bishop. Now, the previous person you interviewed mentioned that the average size of an Amish church group might be 25, 35 families or so. So they keep a small-scale organization, which is very different from, quote, the high churches, such as the big mega churches or the mainstream Methodist, Catholic, Lutheran, Episcopalian churches that we find throughout America. And so there are about 1,900 of these church groups, all with their own bishop, ministers, and a deacon, which are selected by lottery. That is, there's no formal training. Beyond that, there is no cardinal, there is no pope, there is no vertical hierarchy beyond these individual cells of church groups of 25 or so families. But bishops do get together and talk about common issues of the ministry, and that helps with a little bit of the conformity. But quite frankly, the similarity among all Amish groups is really based on their heritage and their history that goes back several hundred years. That is the glue that holds them together. And because there is no hierarchy, there is room for variation from one church group to the other and how they translate their church discipline, which is called the Ordnung or Ordnung. And that safety valve, that pressure valve, allows for some experimentation and on occasion then a rather infamous group like the one over in Burkholz.
Ahmed in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, how you doing? I really like the conversation today. And we always go out to some of the Amish country and we kind of pick some fruits and buy some of the cheese and stuff. But I have a question that always confused me, which is, why do they study the Bible in German? Is it, I mean, I don't understand the relationship of the German language to the Bible. Originally, the Bible wasn't German. It was either Greek or Aramaic. So that's the question that always bothered me with the Amish.
That's a good question, and you could expand the question to say that why do most of us study the Bible in English, especially the King James Version? And in fact, what you need to realize is that the Amish came out of German-speaking areas of Switzerland, southern Germany, and the Alsace-Lorraine area of what is now France. They came up through the Netherlands, assisted by Mennonites, and then came over to the U.S. In fact, they have a tendency to want to use the King James Version of the Bible in English, and it's only been in recent times that a New Testament translation of the Bible in German, and their form of German called Pennsylvania Dutch, has occurred. Now, their church services are conducted in the language that is their heritage from Europe, which is Pennsylvania Dutch. that's really no different than my great-grandparent who came over here from Germany and learned all of her prayers at a Catholic grade school in German. And so you need to think about it in terms of heritage rather than in terms of what the original Bible was written in.
Thanks, Ahmed.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. What can the, looking at the Amish today, what do they tell us about who any of us or all of us were, I mean, about the heritage of this country?
Oh, I think the Amish can teach us a lot. And by the way, I think we can teach the Amish a few things, too. It goes both ways. And I think there are lessons for living that you can derive from the Amish. One in particular is the value of community. Because they have been compelled to maintain a horse and buggy culture with a small church group, they have to live close enough to each other to have Sunday service, which is rotated from house to house. They don't have church buildings. And that also functions then to allow them to help each other, to visit, and to maintain a density of acquaintanceship among each other that allows them to be distinctive from our kind of society. You know, we often live in suburbs without front porches where we fail to know our neighbors very well. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the Amish, I think that's one thing that they can teach us. I think there's a second thing, too. They do not avoid technology. They simply judge technology in terms of whether it will erode their sense of community. And in that sense, they understand very self-consciously how an automobile or a television, et cetera, will affect them and their families and their children. And that's one thing that in a high-tech society like America, we often don't do as well as we should. We make headlong rushes toward the latest iPod or the latest piece of technology, standing in long lines just to get that software or that video game, without thinking about what does that do for our neighborhoods and our families and our future.
We have an email from Hal. He writes, isn't one group glad that the conviction shows the defendants that the state takes their behavior seriously, but that neither group would think that punishment was necessary or warranted?
I'm unsure of the other group he's talking about, but I do know that even before the incident occurred in Burkholz, that bishops in the mainstream Amish were concerned about that Burkholz community. And so there were earlier attempts to get them to be more conscious about how they were behaving and what they believed. And in that sense, then, yes, they are probably feeling as if a lot of these incidents that have occurred after the beard cutting and hair cutting are justified, that eventually this bishop in that community would have done something that would have brought in the intervention of government. And I would also agree that, yes, now that these things have occurred and they've been found guilty, perhaps the sentence from the point of view of many other Amish is pretty harsh, especially in terms of its impact on the children in those families that will now be split up, and where both husband and wife may be serving in jail a long time. After all, those children are innocent, and they have souls, and those souls need to be saved. And so we want them to grow up in a healthy community where they have a chance to live a life that the Amish believe follows the will of God and the philosophy of the New Testament.
You specialize in rural criminology. How common are Amish crimes, even though we might not know about them, within their groups? How common are they? How are they usually resolved?
Most of the crime that occurs against the Amish is small scale, such as a theft or a burglary, things of that sort. In addition, the Amish on occasion do get into trouble, such as a driving under the influence in a buggy, such as contentions between the Amish and local government over sewage systems and violations of other state and local regulations. But I would say overall, the Amish are very conforming and very law-abiding. But when they do commit an offense that leads to an arrest, it certainly makes the news. And then, of course, on my earlier statement about the Amish being victims, we also have to recognize that there's an occasional heinous crime, such as the shooting over at the school in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania.
Right. When all the children were...
When all the children were shot, yes. And that was a very, very serious crime.
There was some pretty lurid information that came out in the trial about Sam Mullet and his group. And it was stuff that, you know, there's issues of possible adultery and that sort of a thing. Those are things they definitely deal with in their own communities. What do they do when they breach the social contract they have with each other?
Right. When you become baptized as an adult into an Amish community, you've taken a holy vow to conform to the church discipline of your small church group, and it's symbolic of conforming to the will of God. And so when there is a severe or intense violation of that, such as breaking a commandment, such as adultery, it tends to result in excommunication without almost immediate confession. Frankly, most of the shunning and the idea of confession in an Amish church is meant to bring somebody who is offending back into the faith. So there's actually a gradation of four types of confession before an Amish church group would get to the point of a more permanent excommunication. However, there are occasions such as adultery or another very serious offense where that you simply might skip from all the way to the last resort because of the nature of that offense. But one of the things that people don't appreciate about the Amish is how much they seek to forgive members who do offend and to keep them in the faith.
Well, Joe Donnermeyer, thanks for sharing your information with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Joe Donnermeyer, he's professor of rural sociology at Ohio State University. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.